few years. This is a photo of it here, but I'll get into explaining a little bit more about it as we go through. So the motivation for this project is to place constraints on dark energy at high-ish redshift. Now, I'm sure you've all seen this figure or variants on this figure before. This is constraints on the luminosity distance placed by type 1a supernova at various redshifts. So we get the luminosity distance to the redshift because supernova, we think, well, type 1a supernova, we think are standardizable candles. And we just can look at the ratio between the observed flux and the luminosity, and that gives us a distance. That allows us to put distances to match up with the redshifts we've found spectroscopically. And we get a whole load of points in here. This is the actual data in this panel. In here, they've just taken the rebinned data. So they've just binned it up into a smaller number of points. And you're just looking at deviations from what is the best fitting curve here. Each of these curves in here corresponds to a different sort of cosmology. So this line here, this black dashed one, is a best fitting kind of lambda CDM cosmology. And all these other things correspond to different models of dark energy, so varying the equation of state and how that varies in various things. So by measuring these points in this distance redshift plane, we can place constraints on the expansion history of the universe and thus on trying to figure out what its contents are and how the contents evolve. The probe of this most people are familiar with is this one, the supernova, one which has been, in the last 10, 15 years, has been getting a lot more traction, is using baryon acoustic oscillations. Now, baryon acoustic oscillations are the remnants of sound waves propagating in the early universe. It's the same signal that you see in the acoustic peaks of the cosmic microwave background. It also leaves a weak imprint in the matter distribution. And we can use this as a standard statistical ruler on the sky. So what we do is we go out, we make a map of the sky, we look at its clustering statistics, so something like its correlation function, and we see a bump. This bump is the baryon acoustic oscillation. So it's an extra correlation you see at about 100 H inverse megaparsecs. And we know reasonably well what the physical scale of this is from cosmic microwave background data. So we know it's about that. However, when we actually do a galaxy redshift survey type thing, we're actually measuring angles and we're measuring redshift separations. So by comparing the angular separation we see of this feature to the sort of known physical scale, we get the angular diameter distance to that redshift. And comparing the redshift separation that this feature seems to have to its known physical scale, we get the Hubble parameter at that redshift. So we can use those constraints to place points in this plane. Again, this is a distance redshift type plane. The same way in the supernova, and we find the points we've heard about many times before. Different expansion histories given by different set contents in the universe give us different curves in here. So that's how we constrain dark energy using this. Now, you can see this is a roughly current set of data. It's a few years old now, but there's been no real great strides forward in this, other than Lyman Alpha, which is like somewhere over there. You can see this kind of ends at around redshift 0.6. So in the past, it's been difficult to like really push these measurements to higher redshifts. There's not a good set of optical lines we can use to do that. And so this has been difficult. What many people have been considering is, can you do this another way, for instance, using the 21 centimeter line to do this? And that's what I'm going to be talking about. So
motivation, for pushing to higher redshift, just to get like early dark energy or something?
Essentially for looking at models of dark energy. If you look at the sort of standard kind of things people look at for things like just a DW, DA kind of things, like just an equation of scale varies with scale, like this isn't the absolute best redshift range to do because that tends to settle out kind of early. But you may find other things.
Well, because I only have so many dollars.
No.
This won't cost you that many dollars in compared to a lot of other things.
Yeah.
Whole thing's priced in Canadian. Okay, so what I'm going to want to talk about is a technique called 21 centimeter intensity mapping. Just a very brief overview. The 21 centimeter line is the transition in neutral hydrogen between parallel spins in the nucleus and the electron to antiparallel spin. So the parallel state has a slightly higher energy. So when you make the transition, you release a low energy photon of 21 centimeters in wavelength. Now, you can define the occupancy of these two states with this quantity called the spin temperature. Exactly what you do with all this is a lot of statistical mechanics that I don't want to go into. The important thing is that if this quantity is higher than the CMB temperature, then you see an excess of photons at this wavelength, and so you see the 21 centimeter line in emission. If it's lower than the CMB temperature, you see the 21 centimeter line in absorption. Now, the spin temperature is controlled by all sorts of astrophysical processes that go on. At low redshift, it is basically coupled to the gas temperature, and it's hot compared to the CMB. So you see it in emission. Overview of where, so we're looking, this 21 centimeter line allows us to see neutral hydrogen. So where is the neutral hydrogen? Well, if you go back to high enough redshift below recombination, it's all ionized, obviously. As you go through recombination, it obviously recombines, and you enter the dark ages, which is a period of the universe where there is no real luminous sources at all. But there is this neutral hydrogen gas. So in theory, you could observe a very pristine state of the universe if you looked at very, very low frequencies. As you get further on, you start to get to reionization. So the first luminous sources are turned on. Now they're starting to produce ionizing photons. And this starts to eat away at the neutral hydrogen gas. So this is Marcel talked a lot about this yesterday. And you get these kind of Swiss cheese effect where the neutral hydrogen gets eaten away, and these bubbles slowly grow and grow until they've all merged and there's no neutral hydrogen left, or at least not quite. So after reionization, there's a small fraction of the hydrogen in the universe is still neutral. It's in dense clumps in galaxies, basically. So where the density is high enough that the recombination rate is faster than the ionizing rate. And so these things are kind of self-shielded against the ionizing background. And so you still have these clumps of neutral hydrogen in galaxies. So if you looked out at the 21 centimeter line at these low redshifts, and this is the kind of era I'm going to be considering in this talk, this is sort of redshift less than 4 or 5, you would see these bright 21 centimeter dots on the sky, and that just corresponds to individual galaxies. And so one thing you might think of doing with this is trying to do something like a galaxy redshift survey. It's worth thinking about what you do in a sort of more normal galaxy redshift survey, something like BOSS. What you do is you look out there, you make an image of the sky, you detect a lot of galaxies with high significance. And then once you've got that galaxy, you put a fiber on it, which is connected to a spectrograph. Then you integrate for some time until you can get the spectrum. And then using that, you get the redshift. And so you've had to basically build a high resolution instrument with a spectrograph in order to essentially to get the three-dimensional position of this thing, because you need to get its redshift, this individual galaxy. And that's difficult because actually you're only really interested in the large scales for cosmology. So for cosmology, you don't care, like an individual galaxy or groups of galaxies and things like that. Like, well, depends exactly what sort of end of cosmology you're talking about. But for things like Baron-Acoustic oscillations, that's not interesting. So there's an idea which has been banging around for 10 years or more now from people like Whaley and others. This idea of intensity mapping. So the idea is if you observe these galaxies with a particular line transition, so for instance, with a 21 centimeter line, by picking the wavelength you're observing that, you're automatically picking a redshift. And so if you pick 42 centimeters, if you observe 42 centimeters, that corresponds to observing the 21 centimeter line at a redshift of 1. And so by doing that, you automatically pulled out the three-dimensional position of this thing. And so you know that whatever you've seen at 42 centimeters would correspond to 21 centimeter redshift 1. So you don't need to resolve the individual galaxies anymore. And so because you don't need to resolve them, you don't need high enough resolution to detect them individually. And so you can get away with a much lower resolution instrument. Now, this allows you to go about your instrumental design very differently to what people were thinking about for these H1 surveys, 10 years ago. So the thinking, sort of 10 years ago, was that you would need to do essentially the exact analog of an optical galaxy redshift survey. So you need to detect all these things at high significance, and then you find that three-dimensional position, and then you just treat them as individual galaxies. With this intensity mapping, all you need to do is basically have a instrument which has high enough angular resolution to resolve the feature you're interested in, but otherwise it's just seeing the unresolved emission. And so you can get away with building, a different kind of radio telescope, something which is like a compact array, which is what I will talk about with CHIME. Now, there's one issue with this kind of approach. The assumption that, very strong assumption that's gone into it, is that the intensity that you're seeing at a particular wavelength corresponds to the 21 centimeter emission at, that the same at the redshift, which corresponds to it. Now, if there was anything else emitting at those frequencies, that would be confusable with the cosmological large-scale structure. And so this is a big problem. So just to illustrate this, this is just a simulation of just a very simple simulation of the 21 centimeter sky. There'll be a few of these in this talk, so it's just worth being clear about what this is. This is just a mole-wide projection of a particular angular slice, so you're just seeing the celestial sphere here. This plot here is a cut through the equator about here, and so that is that direction. And then I've shown you what the frequency direction looks like. It's probably difficult to see at the top, I think, especially as I didn't give this any units, but the amplitude of the signal is around 1 millikelvin at this particular redshift. So this is 400 megahertz, which is about redshift 2.5. This is 450, which is about redshift 2. Now, just remember this number 1 millikelvin. There are other things, unfortunately, which shine at the same wavelengths. One of them is our own galaxy. That has an amplitude of around up to 700 kelvin at these frequencies in the galactic center. And so it's extremely bright. So it's like 10 to the 5 times brighter than the 21 centimeter signal we're trying to go after. And so naively, that would make the thing very difficult. Now,
so where do you get this map from?
Okay, this is simulated. The process by which this has been done is slightly complicated, but essentially what you're seeing here, you can't resolve the fluctuations that have been added. This is the Haslam map at 408 megahertz, and it's been extrapolated in frequency using a spectral image.
But you don't really know for a fact that it's supposed
to. I think most observations that have been done of this kind of thing have indicated that it is smooth, but we don't know the exact level to which it is smooth. That will be critical for these kind of.
Couldn't experiments. You just take one patch, which is maybe bright, and then observe it very well in all frequencies, see how it's smooth.
People have been trying to do that, yeah. So as Niash is hinting at here, if you'd been looking at this closely, you'd see that there is a way you can potentially get around this. The 21 centimeter signal, because each frequency corresponds to a different slice of the universe, tends to decorrelate very quickly. But the foregrounds are basically all generated by synchrotron radiation, and so they're all spectrally very smooth. And so what you would do, when your observations would be essentially the sum of these two maps, but the thinking is if you reject the very smooth part, you get rid of this part, and then you see this part coming out. Now, one way in which that's actually complicated in real life is a problem called mode mixing that I just want to highlight. There's a few problems with this observation program, but one particular one is this one. So, when I started dealing with experimental stuff, it came as a surprise to me that the beams of telescopes are not Gaussians and they're not frequency independent. So in real life, it turns out that a beam has many side lobes. So this is just an instrumental beam. And it gets smaller amongst, you know, the simplest thing it can do is get smaller as you go to higher frequency. So it just has a scaling with the wavelength. It's just kind of typical optical scaling. Now, say there was just one thing on the sky. There's just a single bright point source, and we're observing it with a telescope as on axis. Then, as we go to from low frequency to high frequency, the beam is changing, but because this point source is always on axis, the, you know, the way it looks is very smooth. So we see the intensity varying in a smooth way as you go from low frequency to high frequency. If you move the telescope slightly, and so this point source is off axis, so it would start in the maximum of a side lobe, then at some mid-frequency it's gone to a minimum, and then it's gone to a maximum, you see that the intensity varies, and so you start high, you go to roughly to zero, and then you come back up again. Now, this is obviously problematic, because what's happened is that we thought we were looking at something, just a pure point source, is very spectrally smooth. But actually, you can see that when we would take data of this, we would get a mixing in of, you know, some spectral structure. And this is just because of the frequency-dependent beam. What we've done is we've coupled the angular structure into the spectral structure. So this means you have to be very careful when you try and do these foreground separations to remove the smooth modes, because if you're not, you're gonna see these kind of things, and you're going to struggle to remove the smooth part as you would like. Anyway, on that not so optimistic note, I'm gonna just shift gears slightly and talk about Chime. This is the instrument I've been working on. This is a picture of Chime out at night. You can see lots of nice things, stars and Milky Way and plants and things. Chime is a Canadian project, essentially. It's a collaboration between three universities, McGill, Toronto, UBC, as well as Dominion Radio Observatory, the sort of federal radio observatory. There are many people involved in Chime in this audience, so Whaley, Kendrick, amongst other people. So Chime is, I'll show you some photos later, but this is a schematic of what the Chime instrument will look like. So it is four 20-meter wide, basically cylindrical reflectors. So these are like half pipes, and they each is 100 meters long. Now, if I just put one antenna on here and just pointed it down towards the dish, what you would see is basically a strip which is 2 degrees wide and 120 degrees long, roughly. So this is the part of the sky that single antenna would observe. And that's just because this is a parabolic in one direction, so it only focuses in one direction, and looks like a pure reflector in the other direction. Now, so as something you would observe with, this would be a fairly useless instrument. You're just seeing this like huge swathe of the sky, which you're just integrating over. Now, Chime is an interferometer. So what you actually do is you string large amounts of feeds along each of these feed lines, and then you consider all the pairwise correlations of them in the most traditional sense. And if you take those pairwise correlations, you can combine them together, and you can get angular resolution within this beam. So this beam here essentially represents your field of view. And by looking at all the pairwise correlations, you can form individual beams within this field of view. So this setup here would form basically an array of 4 by 256 beams, each of which is, depending on how you count it, is around 15 arc minutes of resolution. Chime is going to observe between 400 and 800 megahertz. So that's from redshift 2.5 down to about 0.8 with high spectral resolution and with this angular resolution. So it's going to, you know, the idea is that it will make a map of the sky, of whatever you're seeing in the radio sky, with reasonably high spectral resolution and fairly high angular resolution. Not quite as good as a normal interferometer, but that's pretty good. The idea That's been driving it is, as I mentioned, is this intensity mapping for barren acoustic oscillations. There is lots of other science that you could consider doing with it. Chris mentioned yesterday the idea of looking for fast radio bursts and discovering fast radio bursts with this. There's other things you can do looking for pulsars and finding pulsars and timing pulsars. All of these things are being explored. One nice thing about CHIME compared to other projects that have been trying to do this is CHIME is fully funded. So we've actually been making reasonable progress getting on with things.
So when should we see papers coming out of CHIME?
Well, there already have been some papers coming out. They just don't have the kind of results you'd be interested in. But in a several-year timescale, basically. The first, I imagine the first things will be coming out within a year kind of timescale from the prototype. But these would probably have no cosmological interest. Probably get crucified for saying that. Okay, so CHIME is located in Western Canada. It's in British Columbia. This particular map of Canada, it's under the sockeye salmon. But for those of you who aren't that familiar with this map, it's about here. So it's 100 kilometers north of this gray, desolate area down here. In a nice wine-producing region of BC.
Is that where the wildfires are, or where are
the Kelowna? Okay, so there's always wildfires in here. There's recently been some around here and down here. And those are the ones that basically filled Vancouver with smoke for a week. So those are the only problematic ones.
So you've been saying...
Was this event built by radio partners or some funding from government?
Well, I guess a little bit of both. So the Dominion Radio Observatory, the sort of Canadian radio observatory, is located there. So it's on the same site. So just skipping ahead a slide, this is a picture of the site. These are the existing parts of the radio observatory. This is where the full CHIME instrument will go. And this is where we have a sort of, I don't know what it is, like a fifth kind of size Pathfinder instrument, which is already operating. I don't know if you can sort of see it. The other things you can see are kind of old school radio interferometers. So these are kind of like basically telegraph poles with like wire string between them. And these ones are sort of dishes on a old railway track that they can move back and forth. In terms of just the volume that CHIME could theoretically survey, so it's going to see roughly 3/4 of the observable sky with varying levels of noise, and from about redshift 0.8 to 2.5. So if you just plot out what that corresponds to in terms of volume, where I've scaled the angular part and the radial part such that the area of each patch corresponds to the actual volume of the survey. CHIME is this big purple blob, and so it compares very well to existing kinds of redshift surveys. So the kind of classical galaxy ones, Wiggles and Boss and stuff, correspond to these patches. There's a lot more volume in the Lyman Alpha, which is this one. But even like kind of next generation galaxy redshift surveys will, you know, survey this kind of thing. So CHIME should, in theory, survey quite a lot more volume. As you can see, also at a different kind of redshift range to most things I've managed to get so far. So in terms of pure forecasts on the power spectrum, CHIME should be able to place pretty good constraints. This is just doing a very simple forecast of what the power spectrum errors are, so you can sort of eyeball that you're getting like percent or sub-percent level errors across most of the range of the BAO feature. Because everything goes a bit nonlinear and difficult out there to understand, but
it's not linear, you're saying, and maybe it's for the linear power spectrum.
Well done.
Thanks, Neil. Thanks.
Sorry.
Banned from my talks. I guess I'll have to.
Alternate power outage.
Okay. No worries.
You're back.
Yeah. So. So what are you saying? Were the forecasters based on linear?
Yeah. So will reconstruction be important for you guys, or?
Yes, basically. I think to the, so I can't remember what, I mean, these are just the error bars that you would naively forecast from a measurement, pasted onto a, you know, a no wiggles, well, wiggles only power spectrum. But if you want to get the actual precise BAO forecast, then yes, you need some reconstruction at the far end.
I'm just getting the projector on now.
Okay, good, thanks.
Usually when we've been doing forecasts, we've been doing one, you know, both with and without some reconstruction to allow you to push to small scales. It does make a lot, it makes a bit of difference, but
it's higher redshift, I guess.
I don't think you need to rely on
it. You can watch it there if you want.
In the same plot that you had, the error bus was growing around 0.3. I mean, at the highest scale was growing. Is this the beam? What is the preventing to go to high scale?
In this case, it's probably just the, this is adding up a large redshift range. So what it probably is the fact that, you know, because you have two dimensions in the angular one and only one in the line of sight, you, a lot of your information comes in the angular direction. And so as soon as you start going to a scale, you know, smaller than the beam, then you lose your ability to do any to resolve anything with angular stuff. And so although you can go to very fine spectral resolution, I mean, the spectral resolution goes, you know, you have spectral resolution like right out to here somewhere, the angular stuff starts dropping off there. And also this is, you know, the power spectrum is going down at this point as well. So. No, this does not include density field reconstruction. I don't think so. It's a bit of a different thing because you don't, you know, with the kind of more normal density field reconstruction, you actually have like galaxies you can just kind of move. And obviously, this is just a sort of continuous field, but I don't think that's any real barrier to doing it.
You don't have shot noise. That's
just the bias for your H1 galaxy. I mean, because you have to know the bias to get the density field, right?
Well, there would be some
bias
for this, I suppose.
Right? Yeah, but you have to know what it is, don't you?
It's not. I think it's thought to be around one, but it's not. It's not been measured. So the normalization times the bias has been measured, and Whaley with the GBT folks are trying to separate out this and the bias. I think at the moment, but I don't think it's being.
This particular plot, the bias cancels by PMP moves at the same bias. So for this plot. And then the L bot, because I think those L bots are dominated by thermal noise, so finite integration time, I think if you integrate longer, those will keep shrinking at high K. And that L bot does depend on bias. So, not on bias, on the combination of omega H times B is what the L bot depends on.
Yeah,
right.
Because it depends on how big the signal is.
Yes.
And how long is that integration? Is this like 8 years?
This would be 2 years, I think, yeah. Just download viewing. Shifting these kind of constraints into something which is a little more easier to eyeball. If you took the power spectrum measurements, you found the BAO feature, you figured out what its scale was, and you turned it into these, you know, distance redshift plots. This is the kind of constraints you would be getting. This is obviously the kind of picture I showed earlier, and this is just looking at deviations from it. So you see, you know, chime puts, well. The full chime would put like roughly 1% level numbers on here across a very large range in redshift. Even the Pathfinder, which is this prototype one, in theory could place reasonable constraints on here, although that would probably be a lot of work.
5 minutes.
Oh, right. I better really, right. OK. So the construction of the chime has been basically completed. Of the full instrument. So this is just the steel work. This happened a week or two ago. So the next year will be basically filled with trying to put all the instrumentation together to go on this thing. So it's only the steel work that's done. In the meantime, we've been busy with the Pathfinder instrument. So this is this small-scale prototype. To give you an idea of how big it is, this is a standard-sized shipping container here, and this is the instrument. This is a standardized graduate student on the inside. This is Liam, sat over there. Canadian graduate student, yeah. Well, nourished as a child, so quite tall. I've told that joke about 10 times, and we were betting like how diminishing the laughs have been getting. So the Pathfinder had first light at the end of 2013. Since then, we've been trying to get all the instrumentation on and trying to get it all working. It's been a good learning experience for the full thing. The analysis is still ongoing, so I don't have any interesting results really to show. This is some of our first light data. This is just a transit of a point source going through the beam, which was very exciting when we got it. And so hopefully there'll be results from the Pathfinder coming up over the next year or two, something like that. In whatever time Whaley allows me to have left, I wanted to just be a bit indulgent and talk about some of the work I've been doing with the data analysis, in particular new kind of formers when we came up for doing the data analysis. Now, the problem with this, an instrument like Chime, the analysis ends up being very challenging, and there's obviously been a long history of doing radio interferometric analysis, but this just ends up in a very different limit. So the instrument is instantaneously wide field. It's essentially an all-sky service. It's a huge fraction of the sky. And so you can't make a lot of the standard approximations you would make in interferometry. It generates a very large data volume. There's a big problem as well with the foreground removal. So because of this huge ratio between the foregrounds and the signal, that essentially gives you a level of accuracy with which you need to be able to do your analysis so as to not leak foreground into the signal and swamp the signal. There's also an issue with polarized foregrounds and how to prevent polarization leakage, which is a really big problem, but I don't really have time to go into. I will skip a little bit. What I essentially want to say, we've spent a lot of time developing this M-mode formism. I've spent a lot of time working on it with Whaley and Chris, amongst others. The idea of this formalism is that it makes one very strong assumption, is that you're dealing with transit telescopes. So these are instruments like Chime that only see what's above, and they just let the sky rotate. That gives you certain properties of statistical stationarity of your observation, which you can exploit. And then, unlike in the very traditional radio interferometry kind of stuff, everything else falls out. So you can do the rest of the analysis completely exactly. The formalism is naturally full sky and wide field, so there's absolutely no flat sky approximations or anything like that, which would be extremely limiting for what we want to do. One advantage of this technique is it breaks the problem down into smaller sets of statistically independent modes. This means that if you want to do something like an operation on a full covariance matrix, rather than doing a really huge operation, you can break it down to 1,000 operations of 1,000th of the size. So for like a standard kind of n cubed operation, that gives you a saving of a factor of 1,000,000 in computation. So that opens up a lot more techniques for analysis than you would be able to do any other way. In particular, it enables you to do a very efficient and accurate cleaning of the foregrounds, which you can't do with anything else. And so what we can do with this technique is we can use the full covariance of the data, using models of what the signal looks like on the sky and the foreground looks like on the sky, turn those into instrumental covariances, and we can use that to find a very clean statistical separation between the two signals. So we're essentially saying we break it into a set of modes where we can say how much power we expect in the signal versus the foregrounds in every mode. We can just throw away ones that are contaminated by foregrounds. This uses all the available information and so fully treats any mode mixing effect. Just to show you how this works on the foregrounds, this is just, again, simulations similar to what you've seen before. This is the unpolarized part of the foreground. This is the 21 centimeter signal. This is the polarized, one of the components of the polarized foregrounds. One thing I didn't mention that you can see in this is that the polarized foregrounds have spectral structure, which is why you need to be so careful with them. If you apply our technique to the...
sorry, but I guess I don't know what how to see the specular spectrum. Do you see it here?
Yeah, basically this is frequency going in this direction. So hopefully you see this one is extremely smooth. It just has a power law decay. Yeah. This one you can see goes, you know, it's positive, goes negative, goes becomes positive again.
Okay.
It's kind of all over the place. And you can see if you look more closely, there's like finer scale structure in there as well. No, this is just from Faraday rotation.
Okay.
So you know, the light synchrotron light propagates through this magnetized plasma and it gets Faraday rotated, and so it just develops all sorts of spectral structure on the line of sight. So if you apply the technique we've developed to this, you can clean out the foreground almost precisely. So presuming you can't see the color scales at the back, both the unpolarized foreground and the polarized part of the foreground have been projected down to levels which are, you know, small compared to the signal that remains. Now, this was done with full time stream level simulations of the observing process and the analysis, and so, you know, provided the assumptions of what we know about the instrument hold, we expect this to work very well. Hopefully, if I flick back and forth a little bit, you can see that there is structure still in common between the pre-filtered 21 centimeter signal and the post-filtered 21 centimeter signal. Another way of looking at that is just to see what you have lost when you look at the power spectrum of your data, or the power spectrum errors in this case. So this is just a heat map showing the two-dimensional, the errors on the two-dimensional power spectrum. So this is the k perpendicular, this is k parallel. If you had no foregrounds, you can observe all the way, you observe up to some scale here, which is given by the angular size of your beam, and you can observe all the way down to k parallel of zero. If you have these foregrounds you've had to remove, what you've lost is essentially this band here, which is exactly what you expect to lose, because these are the foreground is very smooth along the line of sight, and it's these k parallel modes which are the ones will get confused with smooth line of sight foreground modes. And so those are the ones you can't disentangle.
So why is it to be like a flat line in k parallel? Why is it tilted? Below this.
You mean here, down here?
Yeah. So I see how basically below certain k parallel you cannot see, but why does it depend on k perpendicular again? Sorry. Well, basically on the other words, what maybe I'm just confused. What's the meaning of this 45-degree?
Oh yeah, exactly. Sorry. Yes, this is one just an artifact I haven't removed. So in the 21 centimeter literature, there was speculation for a long time that there was some fundamental information loss that meant you could never see below this 45 degree line, that you would lose all information there. And so what we did is show that that's just basically not true.
How many more slides?
One. Summary. Okay, so just to summarize, I've talked about 21 centimeter intensity mapping, which I think is a promising way of doing these kind of constraints on BAOs. We have a CHIME instrument. The Pathfinder is currently operating. The full instrument has just finished construction. And the analysis part of it is there's a lot of fun challenges. There's a lot of code we've put together, which is available if anyone wants to use it for simulating the radio sky and for doing all the data analysis and simulation. Anyway, thanks for listening. Yes, you can. That's what Whaley and others have been doing with the Green Mac telescope.
Not the time data. When do you expect a cross-correlation? This will probably be your first paper, right, I guess?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, there's certainly large there's patches of the sky which have been surveyed at these redshifts that we could try and cross correlate.
It's been carefully selected that there are almost no optical surveys possible at these redshifts because that's where this is a great advantage to do 21 centimeters. So sadly, there's almost no optical redshifts overlapping in redshift range.
So why did you select again?
Well, because all the other redshifts are being done optically. You know, above redshift 2, you've got the Lyman alpha force surveys. Below redshift 1, you've got Bose and other things. And this range is just very hard in the optical because the lines are hard and just like this is hard.
So just don't have slant quasars, right?
There are some slant quasars, but that's a very small number. I don't know how big the signal is. I mean, in the redshift range.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Bose
is not
observing.
Right?
So maybe
it's not that's like that. You guys what you do, like just try to sign an MOU with people just because I guess it's much easier to do cross correlation than not correlation.
Of course, yeah.
So
yeah.
You do a cross correlation in the first step.
There was another question.